Judge Gaitas, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Theodora Gaitas presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, October 12th, and we have six cases on our calendar this morning. Four of them will be argued here in the courtroom, and we have a Zoom argument and a non-oral as well. You are here for our first argument, and before we get started here, I just want to give you both a few notes. Again, we welcome you to an in-person argument here. We're very excited to be in the courtroom. This case is Stacey Joy Fair on behalf of minor children, respondent versus Corbin James Fair, appellant, A220412. And counsel, you are welcome to argue wherever you're comfortable. You have two options with microphones. The lectern in the center of the room is going to be the one that has the clock, which will count your time down. Appellant will have 15 minutes to argue. Respondent will have 15 minutes to argue, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are making an audio recording of the arguments today, and in order to facilitate that, I ask that you please identify yourself and the party you're representing before you begin your argument. And let us know if you have any preferences as to how we refer to you or your client, and we'll certainly look to you for guidance on pronunciation of names as well, and I apologize if I've already butchered party names this morning. That ends my remarks. We are ready to get started. We'll begin with counsel for appellant. You may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Bridget Landry, last name L-A-N-D-R-Y. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Corbin Fair. May it please the court, appellant is seeking a reversal of the decision to grant respondent Stacey Joy Fair's order for protection on behalf of the party's minor children, AJF, age 12, and JAF, age 8. Orders for protection are governed by Minnesota Statute 518B.01, which sets forth three separate definitions for domestic abuse. The first is, quote, physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, and that's under Minnesota Statute 518B.01, subdivision 2A1. The second is infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault under subdivision 2A2. And the third is terroristic threats, criminal sexual conduct, sexual extortion, or interference with an emergency call under subdivision 2A3. In this case, we are dealing with the first two definitions. The district court found that appellant committed acts of domestic abuse against the children when he, quote, twisted son JAF's arm, causing JAF and daughter AJF to be upset and fearful of him, applied excessive and unneeded restraint to AJF at church, end quote. And that's in the addendum, page 1. It is our position that respondent failed to establish that appellant committed domestic abuse. Respondent failed to establish that appellant actually inflicted physical harm, bodily injury, or assault on either child pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518B.01, subdivision 2A1, and she failed to establish that appellant intended to put the minor children in fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault pursuant to 518B.01, subdivision 2A2. In addition to respondent's failure to present evidence of actual physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, and failure to present evidence of appellant's intent to inflict fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault, and a lack of findings regarding the same, there are other reasons why appellant's actions with the party's children on October 3rd, 2021, do not rise to the level of domestic abuse, which I will address in turn. The second reason respondent failed to establish domestic abuse is that Minnesota Statute Section 609.06, subdivision 1-6, allows a parent to use reasonable force to restrain or correct a child. The third reason is that Minnesota Statute Section 260E, 5.03 subdivision 18B states that abuse does not include reasonable and moderate physical discipline of a child that does not result in injury. The fourth reason is that in this case, the totality of the circumstances, which was discussed in Pachovnik v. Pachovnik, 765 Northwest 2nd, 94, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2009, does not rise to the level of domestic abuse. And finally, even if respondent had established domestic abuse occurred, the relevant circumstances as discussed in Thompson v. Scrimshire, 906 Northwest 2nd, 495, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2018, do not require an order for protection in this case. Regarding the findings and respondents' failure to establish domestic abuse, the findings in this case do not state that appellant actually intended to put either child in fear of imminent physical harm. The findings merely state that by appellant twisting JAF's arm, it caused JAF and AJF to be upset and fearful. However, the record does not actually establish that appellant had the present intent to inflict fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault on the party's children.
Counsel, you had stated correctly that a district court is entitled to consider the totality of the circumstances in making a determination about whether there's domestic abuse sufficient to issue such an order. Isn't a district court entitled to consider inferences from the direct evidence as well? In other words, circumstantial evidence, even where there may not be direct evidence, such as testimony regarding respondent's intent.
Yes, so the totality of the circumstances analysis applies only to the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, and there was no, so when you look at that, you look at a passive abusive behavior, prior acts with the children, and in this case, there was no evidence presented that appellant had prior abusive behavior towards the minor children. And the statute does, while I think the district court can make inferences, the statute still requires that the totality of the circumstances show that appellant had the intent to inflict the fear of harm. And in this case, even if you look at the totality of the circumstances, I do not believe it can be inferred that there was that intent. Because well, first of all, appellant wasn't the one who twisted the arm. So what he did was his son bopped him, punched him in the nose. He grabbed his arm as he was retracting it, held his wrist, and said, "It's not okay to hit people." While appellant was holding his son's wrist, his son was the one that was squirming or twisting to get away. So there is no evidence on the record.
Isn't that a credibility determination? I mean, it seems like a fact-finding by the finder of fact. By the court of was it the kid's fault or the father's?
So the district court is allowed to make credibility determinations, yes. However, in this case, it was not specifically said that appellant's description of what happened was not credible. And he was the only witness to this incident. It was not witnessed by respondent. Respondent presented no other witnesses to this incident. And I think that just generally, if a parent grabs a child's arm or restrains them from doing something that they shouldn't be doing, kids are going to twist and squirm. I think it's there was no specific finding that appellant was not being truthful in what happened with his son. Children often squirm to get away from parents if they don't want to be restrained. And there's nothing in case law or the statute that says parents are not allowed to restrain their children. In fact, in Minnesota Statute 609 Subdivision 1-6, it specifically allows a parent to restrain the children to correct or discipline them. If you look at the definition of, so 609 subdivision 1-6 says that reasonable use of force is authorized when used by a parent, guardian, teacher, or other lawful custodian of a child or pupil in the exercise of lawful authority to restrain or correct such child. And this,
perhaps if this incident was considered in isolation, your argument might have some support. But here, the evidence was this father You know, is not exercising, visitation, supervised visitation as required, is driving 4 hours to see the children at church, had some kind of tense interaction with daughter earlier when she indicated she didn't want to sit with him. Given those circumstances, which are also part of the totality of the circumstances, why couldn't the district court infer that your client had the requisite intent?
So I think, first of all, the fact that there's supervised parenting time, it's not stated the reason for it. And I don't think you can infer that it was specifically because there had been prior domestic abuse. There was
just to clarify my comment relates to the fact that this parenting time was not something that was provided for in the decree. This was sort of outside of the scope of the visitation provided for in the decree.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize for misinterpreting that. So what had happened is the appellant is allowed supervised parenting time at a safety center or as at other places. So prior to this specific incident, he had been going to church to visit the children. He had been having the children at family events. So this wasn't the first time that he had gone to church to spend time with the children. So this had been something that had been consented to and had been happening in this case. And respondent even testified that when appellant goes to church, she asks the children, you know, if they're going to sit with their dad. And if they say, yes, we are, she says, that's fine. And if they say, no, we aren't, she says, that's fine too. So until appellant moved to expand his parenting time, there was not an issue with respondent claiming domestic abuse or bringing the order for protection. In fact, they had been in front of the court a month prior to argue about the expansion of appellant's parenting time. And then all of a sudden, the second or third time of appellant visiting the children at church, there was suddenly a problem. So I don't think that respondent did not present enough evidence to show there's a totality of the circumstances to infer appellant's intent to inflict harm on the children. We have a father who grabbed his son's wrist because his son had punched him in the nose. We have a father who held his child to say, it's okay, I love you, and say goodbye. This is what the district court found was domestic abuse. And if you look at the statute and what respondent presented, there were no photographs of injuries. There were no medical records of any prior injuries. There were no police reports. There were no witnesses to show that appellant had ever actually abused or physically harmed his children. There is absolutely nothing on the record to support an inference based on the totality of the circumstances that appellant had ever abused his children or had ever intended by prior acts to inflict fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault on his children. What we have here is a parent who was imparting on their son that it's not okay to hit people. And the son didn't want to hear that. He didn't want to have his wrist grasped, so he squirmed away, and appellant let him go after he said, it's not okay to hit people. And then we have a father telling his daughter, I love you, it's going to be okay, I wasn't going to hurt your brother. Those are the circumstances that the district court said was abuse. And if this order stands, the court is essentially able to tell a parent that they're not allowed to discipline a child, or if they do, they risk an estranged spouse filing an order for protection to try and interfere and prevent parenting time. I don't believe that's a just result. You don't want to set a precedent where a parent is not allowed to actually discipline a child for hitting a person or for running into the street or for taking some other action that isn't appropriate or safe for a child to take. And that, I think, is why there's another statute that specifically says that a parent is allowed to discipline or restrain a child or sometimes use physical discipline as long as it doesn't cause bodily injury or assault. And that's what we have here. We have a parent disciplining a child and a parent holding a child to explain everything's going to be okay. I don't think that the appellant holding his daughter on his lap to explain that everything's going to be okay and I love you can show an actual intent on the part of appellant to inflict bodily injury, harm, or assault. Those are not the actions of a parent who is intending to cause fear in a child. Those are the actions of a parent who's trying to reassure a child and tell a child that they love them.
Wait, can I ask you real quickly? So the OFP order, what he was ordered to do or not to do, under the existing custody provisions, was he allowed to go to the school? I mean, what changed, I guess?
So what changed was the parenting time, because now he's not allowed to go to church. I was not the attorney at the district court level, so I'm not sure if father was prohibited from going to the school. So I can't, I'm sorry, I'm not able to truthfully answer that question.
No, that's okay, no problem, thanks.
Mm-hmm. The court also, under Thompson v. Scrimshire, has established that even if a moving party showed domestic abuse took place, it does not automatically warrant the issuance of an order for protection. Rather, the court then has the discretion to determine whether or not to grant or deny the petition for the order for protection. So in this case, it is our argument that respondent failed to prove domestic abuse. Like I said, there was no photographs, no police reports, no medical reports, nothing to show that there was actual physical harm or injury to the children. But even if the district court were to say that, there is then also the analysis of whether or not it's appropriate to issue an order for protection. And in this case, we do not believe it is, because not only was there it not shown that there's a history of domestic abuse, but there's an active family court file that was determining the party's parenting time. And that family court file is the more appropriate place to address the parenting time. The parties were in court a month before this order for protection was sought by respondent to address parenting time. And what respondent instead did was basically circumvent that process by trying to get an order for protection to just shut the district court file down. I think the goal is always to preserve parent-child relationships. And by having this order for protection stand instead of allowing the parties to proceed in the district court, it doesn't do this family any good. It doesn't help to do anything to repair the children's relationship with their father. And I see my time is up, so thank you very much.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
For a shorter person.
Good morning. My name is Ruta Johnson, and I represent respondent mother in this appeal. May it please the court. On January 27th of 2022, after an evidentiary hearing, the trial court granted respondent's petition for an order for protection on behalf of the minor children, finding that appellant committed acts of domestic abuse against the children by twisting son's arm, causing the children to be upset and fearful of appellant, and applying excessive and unneeded restraint to daughter. The trial court appropriately exercised its discretion in issuance of the order for protection on behalf of the children. And for that reason, we are asking this court to affirm the trial court's decision. Now, this court reviews the decision to grant an order for protection for abuse of discretion and must view the record in the light most favorable to the trial court's findings.
In that vein, counsel, tell me what it was in the evidence that was presented at the hearing that demonstrated that the child's arm was twisted in a way that caused physical pain, or that the daughter was restrained in a way that was inappropriate given the circumstances. Where did that evidence come from?
Certainly, Your Honor. The evidence came from the party's testimony. And what's most important, I think, is that most of the evidence came from appellant's own admission of what happened. The children's statements with regards to what went on during this incident came in through respondent's testimony and, again, through appellant's testimony. Respondent specifically testified, and I don't believe that any objections to the children's hearsay statements were made in the record, but respondent specifically testified that son approached her immediately after this incident, proclaiming that dad grabbed my arm, dad hurt me. He was upset, he was distraught. Daughter similarly told respondent, which respondent testified to, that I was so scared of dad, I was as scared of dad as when we almost got into an accident 2 weeks ago. Those are important statements. There wasn't a guardian ad litem appointed that could have interviewed the children and presented this information, but the statements still came in. There were no objections made. And again, appellant himself testified that daughter was distraught. He recognized that daughter was fearful that he would hurt son. The daughter was squirming, trying to get out of dad's lap. This isn't a situation where a father lovingly embraces their child and gives a tight hug and then sends them on their way. When you think about this incident, I believe appellant testified that the grabbing of the arm and the restraining of the daughter took about 3 to 5 seconds. That seems like no time. But if you really think about it and slow it down, that is a long time for a child to witness their parent, who they have witnessed in domestic abuse incidents with their mother before.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt your argument. I don't know if you can hear. We're having some really strange feedback here in this speaker. I don't know if I can simply turn it on. Sorry to interrupt your argument, counsel. Of course, we'll stop your time. Maybe try the open microphone. Yeah, would you mind turning it on? I'm sorry.
I can do that. I'm going to guess the
time maybe we'll get some assistance to help with that speaker. Let's see if that works.
As I was saying, so the daughter had been receiving services for trauma therapy based on the domestic abuse incidents that she had witnessed. All of this was in the record and testified to. So daughter is sitting in dad's lap. Son comes up to dad, playfully bonks him on the head. I believe that there was a description that it was like a knuckle sandwich where son squeezed dad's nose between his two knuckles. That's not a behavior that needs correcting. So son does this, dad grabs son's arm to the point where daughter, who is witnessing this right in front of her, becomes so distraught that she is telling dad, let him go. This is something that dad specifically testified to, and it is in the transcript on page 21. Counsel examining dad asked him, and you said the daughter became concerned that you were going to hurt son, right? Dad answers, yes. Did she voice that to you? Dad answers, yes, she did. Did she tell you to let him go? Yes, she did. And that is because she thought you were going to hurt him, right? And dad says, in her mind, yes. I believe she thought that.
Counsel, would you agree that there is a lot of this depends on the circumstances at the time. In other words, there could be two potential interpretations of this situation. You know, one, completely benign, and the other less benign. And the district court here considered the circumstances and went with the less benign interpretation of the incident. Yet, in our review, wouldn't it be appropriate for us, looking at the cold record of the case, to determine that what happened here didn't rise to the level of domestic abuse?
Your Honor, that's an excellent point. However, that is not the role of this court. It's well established that although a different result is possible, that is not the standard of review. So when this court reviews the evidence and the record, Your Honors look at, does the record support the findings of the court? And it is not the Court of Appeals' role to reverse based on a different possible outcome. We know that the Domestic Abuse Act is supposed to be viewed in, again, the light most favorable to the injured party. It requires liberal construction. And so this is one of those situations where just because a different result is possible, it doesn't mean that the district court abused its discretion. There's a lot of circumstances that the district court had available to review. There were a slew of different factors presented to the court that led the trial court to believe that based on the totality of circumstances, there was, appellant did intend to inflict fear of imminent harm on the children, and the same totality of circumstances applies to the analysis of, is an order for protection necessary in this case? And the court determined yes on both accounts. And those factors are that the son was subject to a criminal domestic assault matter. That was indicated in the petition for an order for protection, and it's on page 11 of the addendum. Appellant routinely intimidated parishioners. One of the parishioners testified that appellant would stand in the back of the church, arms crossed, watchfully peering over the congregation as well as the children and respondent. Appellant routinely followed respondent and the children out to the car, watched them after church service. All of these things were intimidating and fearful. There is history of domestic abuse in this relationship. This is, again, evidenced in the record by the testimony that the court received.
Counsel, why was your client okay with seeing the children at the church?
Your Honor, I think respondent testified that she wanted to reassure the children that if they want to maintain, and I'm inferring some of this, a safe relationship with their father, she would support that. There are certainly enough allegations in the record to show that, or to suggest that perhaps mom was alienating the children from dad. That is not accurate. What the respondent was doing is, like I said, she was trying to reassure the children that they can have a safe relationship with their father and support them in any way that the children felt safe to do that. And so if that meant that around the congregation, the children would want to sit with their dad, she was okay with that. But that doesn't undermine her concern for the children's safety overall based on the history of this case. As I said before, daughter was receiving trauma therapy to address the domestic violence that she had witnessed between father and herself.
And counsel, is it your position that this was all fair game for the district court to consider in conjunction with the allegations regarding what happened that specific day?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The totality of circumstances is a big factor that the court has to consider. And so all of the information that is available to the court through the record that was presented is fair for the court to consider. There certainly weren't any objections with the exception of the letter that respondent's attorney asked the court to take judicial notice of. I believe the court declined to do so, but there still was enough information to get the court to that totality of circumstances analysis.
So how do we reconcile the statute allowing parents to use reasonable force with what happened in this case? I mean, how do we say, oh, no, this is unreasonable? We know that's the conclusion that the district court came to, but how do we reconcile those two? I mean, he did get bopped in the face by his son.
Your Honor, in terms of what reasonable force would be, the court has to look at, again, the circumstances surrounding the incident. Appellant certainly in their brief discussed malicious punishment of the child statute as well as assault statutes or what is required for to find a child to be in need of protection or services. And what's similar in those circumstances is that, again, looking at the event that led to the discipline or the act that required discipline, what was happening? So appellant would like this court to think that if this order for protection is affirmed, then parents are not going to be able to protect their children from harmful behaviors like reaching for a hot stove or running into traffic. But when you look at what's reasonable, there's a fairly clear distinction here. Is there an act that a child engaged in that requires discipline or restraint? And if appellant himself testifies that this was a playful event where a child ran up to him, bopped him on the nose, But it resulted in such a strong aggressive reaction of grabbing, leaving marks on the arm, and then restraining another child to do some damage control to explain to her that this was actually okay. I know maybe you were afraid that I would hurt your brother, but that is not what was happening. It undermines those feelings. So in terms of reconciling the statute, we have to look at the totality of circumstances. We have to look at the history, and we have to look at the behavior of everybody involved. Did the child's behavior warrant discipline or correction? And the answer in this particular case is no. Your Honor, that is a great question, but that is not what is before the court today. We can't look at this incident in a vacuum, because it didn't happen in a vacuum. We don't know how the children would have reacted. We don't know, had there not been that history, what this would have looked like, what everybody's response would have been. What we do know is that there is a significant history of domestic violence. Parenting time of father is restricted to a safety center. That is a significant piece here. There have been past physical incidents between father and the children. The children reported being fearful of father based on this incident and prior incidents, and that is the context that we have to look at this case on. Before my time runs out, I also want to mention that the burden that petitioner respondent in this case had at the level of trial court was preponderance of evidence. That is not an exceedingly high burden, and there certainly is enough evidence in the record to support an issuance of the order for protection. And for that reason, respondent again respectfully requests this court to affirm trial court's issuance of the order for protection on behalf of the minor children.
Thank you very much for your argument and for your flexibility in switching locations and microphones during the argument. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I think we've discovered that it doesn't really matter where you stand. We've got just a problem with the speaker, which just people just cleverly turned off. So wherever you're comfortable, given your rebuttal, please feel free to go there.
Will it be okay if I go back to this?
It will be, okay. Yeah. We've just turned off. I mean, nobody's mic, but I think we can all hear each other just fine. You can hear us, right?
Yes.
All right. So you're good where you're comfortable, and you may begin when you're ready.
Okay. Thank you. Again, Bridget Landry for the appellant in this matter. While the burden is the preponderance of the evidence, respondent still had to meet the statute to present evidence to show that there was actually physical harm, bodily injury or assault, or the intent of appellant to cause a fear in the children of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. In this case, she presented no photographs of any injuries, no police reports, no medical records. She herself admitted that she did not witness the incident that she claims serves as the basis of domestic abuse. She presented no other witnesses who claimed to have seen the incident of what occurred between appellant and his children.
But there was evidence that there were at least red marks. I mean, is that enough to be a physical injury? Or are you saying that that alone is not enough?
In the prior case law that regards orders for protection, there has to, at least with the case law, there has to be an actual lasting injury, bruises, things like that. There's no case law that says leaving a temporary red mark, which can happen even if I grab my own arm, but it disappears. There was nothing to show that there was any sort of actual injury to the child. And I think...
Counsel, when we're talking about assault, we're talking about not only an injury, but the infliction of fear of harm. And the evidence, at least, that was not objected to that came in seemed to indicate that the children were evidencing extreme fear of harm based on this interaction. And that's what Mother observed. Doesn't that at least provide circumstantial evidence that your client did something that caused that fear?
So I think, yes, mother testified that the daughter said she was scared and that the son was crying. However, any child will cry after they get disciplined by a parent. That is not an unusual reaction when you get in trouble. And as far as the daughter, there were objections on the record as to hearsay. I know the court had asked some of those questions. But I think what's even more important to note when you're looking at the totality of the circumstances is that was not even met. So if you look at the actual record, in the past 4 years of there being supervised visitation, whether it was at a safety center or at the church or at family events, there had never been a single report that appellant had acted inappropriately with the children. There had never been any police reports, allegations of inappropriate behavior, any sort of evidence of physical injury or medical records. There was not, and these are all situations where appellant is surrounded by witnesses with his children, and there was absolutely nothing reported that he was doing anything inappropriate to cause fear or physically abuse these children. As far as what was actually testified to, and again, appellant was the only person who witnessed this incident. Respondent admitted she did not see anything. Appellant testified that, quote, he came up to me and said, bye, Dad, and punched me in the nose. Just like he didn't have any aggression about it. He was just being a kid. And before he could retract his arm all the way, I grabbed his arm right at the wrist long enough to tell him that you don't behave that way. And when I grabbed his arm, he was twisting, trying to get away. It all happened in a matter of a few seconds. It was long enough for me to, I grabbed his wrist and told him we don't do that, and then I let him go. I never pushed him off of me. He never got up on me. I don't know what any parent would be allowed to do in that situation if they can't reprimand their child for punching them in the nose. And that's at the transcript on page 13. And on page 84, again, he testifies. So my right hand, which was on my daughter's knees, with that hand, I was able to get a hold of his wrist before he could retract his arm all the way. And I held it long enough to tell him that is not how we behave. Like, you don't do that. And while I was holding his wrist, he was squirming, twisting around, trying to get away for the 3 to 5 seconds that it happened. And when he left, he wasn't crying. And regarding the daughter, appellant again testified, and when I had JAF's arm and him twisting around, I believe AJF thought that I was the one doing the twisting, and she became concerned that I might actually hurt him. So after I let JAF go, AJF told me that she should probably go, she needs to go, and I held her on my lap for just a few seconds, just long enough to tell her that it was okay, I wasn't going to hurt him, I love you, and that was it. There was no words exchanged between appellant and his children that would have inflicted a fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, assault. When the evidence is actually considered, not reweighed, but considered, it is clear that respondent has not met her burden in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. And the matter is now submitted to this court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you. Thank you.